In this year, marked by two major anniversaries, the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War and the 70th anniversary of D-Day, another conflict should not be forgotten: France's war to retain its colonies in Indochina. 60 years ago, on the 7th of May, 1954, after a battle lasting 56 days, the French army surrendered to the nationalist forces of Ho Chi Minh at Dien Bien Phu in the remote mountains of northwest Vietnam. I'm Professor Julian Jackson, and you're listening to the story of the siege of Dien Bien Phu on BBC World Service. In the history of decolonization, that process in which European powers were forced more or less willingly to relinquish their imperial possessions overseas, this was a unique event. The only time a professional European army was decisively beaten by native forces in a pitched battle.
Dien Bien Phu were described by both French and Americans as the most powerfully entrenched camp ever seen in Indochina, a fortress that could not be destroyed at the time.
This was not just a guerrilla skirmish. It was a defeat almost as humiliating as that of France by the Germans in 1940. The shock was profound, the consequences immeasurable. The US Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles.
The Chinese communists have been supplying the forces of the Viet Minh rebels with munitions and trucks and anti-aircraft guns, radar, technical equipment and technical advisors. They have, however, stopped short of open armed intervention. And in this respect, they may have been deterred by the warnings which the United States has given that such open intervention would lead to grave consequences which might not be confined to Indochina.
For the few survivors of the battle still alive today, the memories remain vivid and intense. French army nurse, Geneviève de Gallard.
The artillery fire was clearly audible. There was a real impression of a descent into hell, the like of which I had never experienced.
Colonel Jean Luciani.
At Eliane 2, the Viets were stopped when only 5 meters short of the French lines, whereupon they went back down. They confirm this in their records, the battalion leaders revealing how after advancing up on the assault of Huguet and then falling back, their battalion, which had comprised some 600 men, had been reduced to just 15.
For the Vietnamese too, this was a defining moment in their struggle towards independence.
In Subsector Isabel, enemy troops tried to retreat hastily to Lao, but they were all captured. The historic campaign of Dien Bien Phu ended at 24 o'clock on May the 7th, 1954.
The French Empire in the Far East, what came to be called Indochina, went back to the 19th century. It consisted of protectorates over Cambodia and Laos, and what is today United Vietnam. Professor Martin Thomas.
France in the late 19th century, I think, saw Indochina with Vietnam very much at its heart as the ultimate proof that the second French Empire, the empire that was being constructed in the wake of the occupation of Algeria in the early 19th century and really almost in compensation for French losses in Europe and particularly, of course, in the war with Prussia in the 1870s, Indochina was proof that this was much more than an Afrocentric project and was genuinely global.
The European population of Vietnam was small, about 40,000 in the 1930s, but Indochina was a source of exotic and orientalist fantasies, and also of profits from the production of rubber. But early on, French rule was already being challenged by nationalist forces. By the end of the 1930s, the main rebel leader was a young man known to history by his pseudonym of Ho Chi Minh.
Far away across the ocean, Far beyond the sea's eastern rim lives a man who is father of the Indochinese people, and his name, it is Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh.
Born around 1890, Ho had in the interwar years created a clandestine communist party in Indochina. But the real blow to French power in the Far East came after the fall of France in 1940 at the hands of Germany. In the wake of this defeat, the Japanese effectively took over Indochina. Then, after the Japanese surrender following Hiroshima, a power vacuum opened up, which gave Ho Chi Minh his opportunity.
Moscow became the hub of world communism, the Comintern. The men in control were shadows, but their purpose was clear: to incite revolution the world over.
As a member of the Comintern, the young Ho had spent the 1920s in Paris, where he helped found the French Communist Party. Moving to Moscow, he spent almost a decade immersed in Soviet communism. When Ho returned to Vietnam during World War II, he saw his country engulfed by a terrible famine. Neither the Japanese nor the French had attempted to alleviate the suffering. As they stockpiled rice, almost 2 million Vietnamese died. New recruits now rushed to the nationalist cause and Ho Chi Minh.
And the hunger of the Indochinese people, foreign soldiers on every hand. Ho, ho.
He declared the independence of the Republic of Vietnam on the 2nd of September 1945. Although, in fact, he only controlled the north of the country, around Hanoi and the Tonkin Delta.
Spending a life of almost 80 years and credited with the defeat of the Japanese, French and Americans in Vietnam, he has been variously called the Venerable Father of the Nation, the Washington of Vietnam, or simply Uncle by millions of Vietnamese who venerate him to the point of calling him a Bodhisattva, the savior of mankind, on an equal footing with the historical Buddha.
Clashes took place between the French and Ho's Viet Minh forces in Tonkin in December 1946. And, without any real decision being taken, the French found themselves sucked into a protracted war of colonial reconquest. Historians sometimes compare the smoother process of British decolonization with the bloody wars fought by the French first in Indochina and later Algeria. The comparison is only partly valid. After all, the British fought small wars in Malaysia and Kenya. But it is true that for France, the empire became a kind of compensation for the defeat of 1940, a way of wiping out the stain of that humiliation. The post-war British felt they had less to prove, as Malcolm MacDonald, British High Commissioner in Southeast Asia, remembered.
Ho Chi Minh would have been ready for the same friendly association, continuing association between an independent Vietnam and France, as India and Pakistan and Ceylon were already establishing with Britain after they had become independent. But the French did not believe that their overseas colonies should become completely independent nations. They thought they should remain a part of what they called the French Union, and that these overseas lands and their peoples were a part of France and the French, overseas France. They would, of course, enjoy a lot of internal self-government in their own affairs, but power would rest with the central government of the Union in Paris, which would control foreign policy and defense policy and certain economic policies and so on. The French wouldn't give way, and so war was inevitable.
For France, the financial burden of the war was becoming unsustainable. It was only made possible thanks to American aid.
American planes, guns, and ammunition are helping the French and Vietnam forces. Russian and Chinese weapons are aiding the Viet Minh. Thus, the clash is between East and West, and the prize is no longer just Indochina, but all Southeast Asia.
By 1954, the year of Dien Bien Phu, America was providing 80% of the total cost of France's war. But if the Americans were providing the funds and supplies, the French were the ones who were fighting and dying. By 1954, there were 50,000 French professional troops in Vietnam, plus 14,000 soldiers of the Foreign Legion. The French government wanted to find a political solution, but from a position of strength. And this was the mission of the new commander-in-chief, General Henri Navarre, appointed in May 1953. Navarre's role was not to win the war, but to prepare an honourable exit. His plan comprised two stages. In 1953, he aimed to pacify the south of Vietnam below the 17th parallel. Meanwhile, in the north, the French would remain on the defensive while building strong positions, allowing them to carry out an offensive in the following year. The site chosen for this purpose was an obscure provincial town whose name was soon to become all too familiar in Paris, Washington, and London, Dien Bien Phu.
The French plan was to create at Dien Bien Phu, deep in hostile territory, a fortified base which would threaten the enemy's supply lines to Laos. Just as important, the fort might act as bait, luring the Viet Minh to attack with their best troops. The base could be supplied from Laos overland, and it could also be reinforced by air. The result they hoped for would be a set-piece battle that would allow superior French firepower to inflict a decisive defeat on the Viet Minh.
The French alighted on Dien Bien Phu because it commanded access to Laos, which had a nominally independent government loyal to France. Laos had become the site of Viet Minh incursions and needed to be protected. After a lost battle, myths always develop about what went wrong. One such myth is that Dien Bien Phu was situated in a kind of hollow, which made it a sitting target, a dangerous trap for the defending forces. And Michael Charlton tells us how the French High Command saw the valley militarily.
In a large amphitheatre of ground, surrounded by hills, shrouded in mist, and densely grown with jungle, far away from the centres of population, near the border with Laos, the French deliberately issued an invitation to Ho Chi Minh's peasant army to come down and fight. They believed that their apparent vulnerability would delude the Vietnamese communists into accepting enticing odds, but that the firepower of a Western garrison would prove decisive and make this place a killing ground.
Dien Bien Phu, surrounded by rings of forested hills and mountains, which rose from about 1,500 feet up to 5,000 feet on the outer ring. In itself, the position was defensible, providing the defenders could hold on to the ring of inner hills. The valley also had a former airstrip, which suited the French tactics, as military historian Martin Windrow explains.
Because a modern French army, with wheeled transport, relying on trucks, towed artillery and light armoured vehicles, couldn't operate on the roads in this whole sector of the country, inserting them behind enemy lines by air and forming not self-sufficient fortresses, but fortresses that could be continually supplied by air, in theory, made perfect sense.
Operation Castor was one of the largest airborne operations in military history. For 48 hours between the 20th and 22nd of November 1953, waves of aircraft dropped six battalions of parachutists into the valley, a total of 4,500 men.
This is Indochina today. No longer is the fighting there a mere skirmish with terrorists, it is war. French paratroops drop into Dien Bien Phu, the very center of the conflict. The situation at this fortress camp clearly indicates how the pattern of the fighting has changed.
In addition, they dropped artillery and even a bulldozer to prepare the airstrip. The bulldozer fell into a rice paddy and another had to be sent. Initially, Castor was a success. The parachuters cleared the valley of Vietnamese forces and the French were able to start flying in supplies and troops, replacing the parachutists who had prepared the way. Among the arrivals was a 28-year-old French army nurse, Geneviève de Galard.
On entendait les tirs d'artillerie, c'était un bruit d'enfer. Ça avait vraiment un sentiment d'une descente en enfer et j'avais jamais vécu ça.
The artillery fire was clearly audible. There was a real impression of a descent into hell, the like of which I had never experienced. And I knew that on the following day, when the noise of the Viet Minh artillery died down, there would, as always, be a moment of calm, when by daylight the stretcher bearers could move the wounded.
Il y avait toujours un moment de calme de jour, et à ce moment-là, avec le jour, les brancardiers.
By night, the presence of barbed wire and trenches made this impossible. We felt the troops were gathering around Dien Bien Phu and that we were heading for heavy fighting.
The French commander, Colonel Christian de Castries, was completely confident. He was certain that aircraft could supply all the base's needs. Only enemy artillery posed any real danger. Some Viet Minh guns had begun to fire on the base, but the French were sure that only a handful could have been deployed in such difficult, hilly terrain. As for Viet Minh supplies and reinforcements, French air power would make sure they never reached Dien Bien Phu.
By the start of the battle, the Viet Minh had amassed about 50,000 troops and considerable quantities of artillery and material in the hills around Dien Bien Phu. Chinese aid was vital, and indeed one of the keys to the ultimate French defeat. The Chinese sent in some 2,000 tons of food, 60,000 shells, 100 artillery pieces.
After analyzing strong and weak points of Dien Bien Phu camp, the Politburo of the Vietnamese Labour Party decided to put it out of action.
Much of the equipment consisted of guns and artillery captured from retreating South Korean and United Nations forces in Korea. This material was transported by tens of thousands of coolies, many of them women and children, carrying material hundreds of miles through the jungle, day and night. Martin Windrow.
Where General Giap and the Viet Minh surprised the French, where they were underestimated, is their ability to move artillery and supplies and ammunition across huge distances of these very poor roads through the jungle by using mass human transport and a few improvised other methods such as bicycles with carrying baskets strapped to them.
Professor Martin Thomas.
In many respects, the most significant weapon of the battle is the Peugeot bicycle. It's not, you know, the 105mm howitzers and all the rest. It is the unrelenting capacity of the Vietnamese state to keep its effort going. And it's a close-run thing, but it's a testament, if you like, to the commitment of ordinary Vietnamese to the outcome of this conflict.
This was one of the most extraordinary logistical successes of the Viet Minh operation. It required massive resources of manpower and also much ingenuity. The routes were hidden as far as possible from the French aviation by being concealed in the undergrowth of the forest. When destroyed by French warplanes, they were simply rebuilt. Back in Hanoi, the overall French commander in the north was René Coigny, a flamboyant and publicity-hungry general who only reluctantly agreed to Navarre's pressure to send more troops to Dien Bien Phu. The commander at Dien Bien Phu itself was Colonel de Castres, an aristocratic cavalry officer who had no experience of defensive warfare. Castres was rumoured to have given the names of his former mistresses to the ring of hills surrounding the base, Dominique, Eliane, Huguette, Isabelle, Gabrielle. In the view of Yvon Cadeau, Castres was in every way the wrong man for the job.
The third figures, the third characters of this tragedy was the General Christian de la Croix de Castres, the type of the cavalryman you know. And before 1940, it was not a good soldier. When you see his report, you know that it was not a good soldier. But with the German attack in 1940, he became a very, very good commander, and many times wounded. It was not the good person to assume the defense of a garrison like Dien Bien Phu. The General de Castres never imposed his mark on the battle. An example, it was the aftermath of the fall of Gabriel Stronghold. He didn't do what he should. There was not effective counter-attack. And it was in my opinion, possible to take Gabriel again. Because a lack of character. During the battle, General de Castres should have imposed his mark on the battle. But even if he had to do it, the face of the battle would have changed.
On the Viet Minh side, the commander was General Giap, a former schoolteacher who had been involved in anti-colonial activities since the 1930s. Giap, who died last year a national hero of Vietnam at the age of 102, had no formal military training. He learned to become a military leader during the guerrilla warfare, first against the Japanese and then against the French. Was he, as some have suggested, a military genius? Yvon Cadeau again.
One thing is obvious. Giap is a kind of self-made man. Sure. No military education.
Had he no military education? Had he not been to an officer's school?
He was a teacher. He teach history. So he read many, many books. Certain historians said he read Clausewitz, but if he read Clausewitz, it was not in the mountain with a very little candlelight. It was a very clever, intelligent man, not a genius. And French officers made big mistakes sometimes, and Giap exploited these mistakes.
I'm Professor Julian Jackson, and you're listening to the story of the siege of Dien Bien Phu on BBC World Service. Join me again in a few moments after the latest news.
The BBC World Service, the world's radio station.
This month's BBC Africa debate comes from Johannesburg, South Africa.
It's 20 years since South Africa's first democratic elections and a landslide win for the African National Congress.
For some, ANC policies meant social mobility and wealth. But for many poor South Africans, democracy has yet to bring basic services in a country the World Bank says is among the most unequal in the world.
Dissatisfaction has led to protests, and as the nation heads to the polls in May, critics want voters to spoil their ballots.
So, has democracy delivered for South Africa?
Can anyone truly challenge the ANC's rule, and does the party of Nelson Mandela have what it takes to move the country forward?
Join me, Audrey Brown,
and me, Lerato Mbele,
on the BBC Africa Debate.
Online at bbcworldservice.com.
I'm Professor Julian Jackson on the BBC World Service, and in part two, I'll be continuing the story of one of the most significant battles of the 20th century, the siege of Dien Bien Phu.
A few hours ago, Dien Bien Phu has fallen. Its defense of 57 days and nights will go down in history as one of the most heroic of all time.
Join me again after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The United States says the release of international observers abducted by pro-Russian militants in Ukraine is a step in the right direction, but that the Kremlin needs to do much more to de-escalate the situation. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, said Moscow should now withdraw its support from the militants. The observers, who've now arrived safely in Kiev, were freed less than a day after a Russian envoy arrived in Slovyansk. Heavy fighting has broken out between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian militants in and around the eastern town of Kramatorsk. Government forces appear to have surrounded the town and say they've taken over some buildings in the centre. There have been two explosions in the Kenyan city of Mombasa, killing at least three people and injuring many others. The authorities say the fatalities were caused by the first blast, which took place on board a bus. The other one went off near a resort hotel on the coast. Hundreds of illegal migrants have arrived in the northern Sudanese town of Dongola after being rescued from the desert by the Sudanese army. The migrants were found after being abandoned by traffickers on the border between Libya and Sudan. At least nine of them died. Afghan officials have said they've ended the search for more victims of landslides in the northeastern province of Badakhshan, and the area will now stand as a mass graveyard. No sign of the villages remains, and those missing are thought to have been covered by metres of rock and mud. A panel advising Pope Francis has called for Roman Catholic bishops to be held accountable if they fail to report suspected sexual abuse or fail to protect children from paedophile priests. The new Vatican Advisory Board said current church laws were out of date. The Confederation of African Football has banned the Gambia from all African football competitions for 2 years. The country was found to have fielded five overage players in a qualifier for Africa's under-20 championship. BBC News.
I'm Professor Julian Jackson, and you're listening to the story of the siege of Dien Bien Phu on BBC World Service. Vietnam, in the 20 years after World War II, was a microcosm of geopolitics, and the battle for Dien Bien Phu was its tipping point. On the Viet Minh side, the leader was General Giap. His obituary ironically suggested that Napoleon was an influence.
Curiously, he was very interested in French history. Napoleon Bonaparte was one of his idols. He learned everything that Napoleon was writing about military science. That made him feel that he should do something for his own country.
Giap was certainly an able, resourceful and charismatic leader. But his main asset consisted in an almost unlimited supply of infantrymen. He adopted the tactic of digging hundreds of miles of shallow trenches to allow his forces to approach the French outer defences. Through these trenches, artillery was transported and then reassembled, all out of sight of de Castres' men.
In fact, the Viet Minh artillery was so well hidden that the French artillerymen couldn't see any guns during the battle at all.
At 5:10 p.m. on the 13th of March 1954, Viet Minh artillery was unleashed on the defenders of the command post on Gabriel Hill. For an hour and a half, shells poured down ceaselessly on the terrified defenders who had never experienced anything like this before, as Belgian former legionnaire Georges Gerbhardt recalled in a BBC documentary.
You cannot possibly get out of here. You cannot possibly survive this. And, you know, once you have come to terms with this kind of feeling, you know, that is when the soldiers become really fanatical. See, that is when they stand like rock, you know, as I've seen the Legion standing. They just couldn't be moved. There was no question, you see, of any of the positions being evacuated at Dien Bien Phu. They were all swamped. They were overrun. And the guys just died where they stood.
After the shelling ceased, waves of infantry, outnumbering the defenders by 10-1, moved into attack. By midnight, it was all over. Gabriel Hill had fallen. On the next night, much the same occurred on the other northern hill of Dominique. And by the morning of the 15th of March, less than 48 hours after the commencement of the battle, the two hills had fallen. Martin Windrow.
General Giap was able to keep sending those human waves week after week after week out of the mud of the trenches into the barbed wire, the explosions and the machine gun fire.
These two hills were the strong points protecting the airfield, which was from now on entirely unusable. The defensive camp had lost its main lifeline and could now only be supplied by the much less reliable form of planes making parachute drops, but these were vulnerable to enemy aircraft guns. And the French could no longer evacuate their growing number of casualties by air. So the wounded were treated in an underground bunker. Geneviève de Galard.
The garrison had an underground hospital. Obviously, it was only a hospital by name, as it did not have the comfort of a hospital. There was a central corridor to the right with the casualty wards with metal bunk beds, 12 beds, three high. And to the left, there was a small corridor which led to the operating table. And to ensure optimal conditions for the prevention of blood poisoning, the walls of this operating room were lined with parachutes.
Dans leur corps, jusqu'à ce qu'ils puissent être libérés et évacués sur un œil.
From this point on, it is hard to see how the battle could ultimately have been won by the French. But the question was, how long could they hold out? The countdown to the Geneva conference had begun. How had this initial disaster occurred? Certainly, there was a failure of leadership on the part of Castres, who had reacted much too slowly to events. His counterattack to take back the two hills was too slow and too late. Although Castres remained in charge of the battle until the end, he spent more and more time isolated in his quarters, and much of the effective control fell to Colonel Longley, who commanded the elite paratroopers. It is sometimes alleged that French intelligence had badly underestimated the extent of the Viet Minh artillery. But in fact, the French were remarkably well informed. What they had underestimated was the success of the Viet Minh in camouflaging their artillery and making it impossible for the French commanders to utilize their air power, as Professor Nicky Cooper explains.
It was unthinkable that a large power like France, with the second largest empire, could possibly be beaten by colonials who were necessarily at the time viewed as inferiors. And this came out in what the French said about the Vietnamese. You know, they were going to go over there and casser du Viet, you know, casser du Viet, break the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese were referred to as les petits jaunes, the little yellow people. And this was backed up by the fact that the French obviously did have superior firepower and weaponry. And of course, as we know, they were supported financially in terms of arms as well by the United States at the time.
The first fighting had also been costly for the Viet Minh, who suffered some 4,000 casualties in the first 3 days. So it was not until the 30th of March that Giap was ready for his next offensive, this time against five hills to the south. The next 10 days, from the 30th of March, witnessed some of the fiercest fighting. One of the hills, Elian Tu, was taken by the Viet Minh one night and then retaken by the French the next. This grueling combat took its toll on both sides. And from the 10th of April, Giap changed his strategy. The Viet Minh abandoned further frontal attacks and continued the tactic of building trenches and tunnels to get as close to the enemy as they could. The aim was gradually to tighten the noose around the French and wear them down by attrition. As in any such conflict, morale was an important factor in the battle. Certainly, General Giap thought so, as he later recalled.
Our army's principal strength lies in its morale, its fighting spirit, and the population's unreserved support, and in its technique.
The French senior officers were shaken by the initial defeats. After the loss of the first two hills, the French artillery commander, Lieutenant Colonel Pirot, had retreated to his bunker on the 15th of March, held a grenade to his chest and took out the pin. His suicide was hushed up for some days, but soon became known and obviously did no good for the morale of the defenders. This was an atrociously grueling battle reminiscent of the First World War. Martin Windrow.
The height of the fighting for Dien Bien Phu, which coincided with the arrival of the monsoon rains, was extraordinarily similar to our mental image of the fighting at Verdun in the First World War. It was a war of trenches creeping closer to one another, constant shell fire, mud which got up to their knees, very little sleep, very little food.
Colonel Luciani, badly wounded twice in the battle for Elian Hill, remembers what fear meant as the noose tightened on Dien Bien Phu.
Oui, alors quand les Viet sont arrivés, ils ont commencé par enlever les tranchées du bas.
When the Viets arrived, they took and cleared the lower trenches, climbed further up, then after a while they stopped because we held control of the front line. That's where courage can be seen at its best, when defending and witnessing the enemy approaching in ever greater numbers, getting ever closer, but nevertheless holding their positions right to the end. In attack, raised voices can generate courage, yet when defending, courage is at its most impressive.
De plus en plus nombreux et de plus en plus près de lui et qui reste à son poste jusqu'au bout, ça c'est du vrai courage.
While Dien Bien Phu was turning into a kind of tropical hell, the French public at home knew little of the reality, which only made the shock of defeat more terrible when it came.
Towards the end, I think they were getting fed up of it. You could almost see a return to the attitude of the 1880s when France initially conquered Indochina, in that it was perceived as wasteful of French money and French blood. By 1954, the war in Indochina, which had initially been a war of colonial reconquest, was again being viewed as unimportant to France. France should have been concentrating on internal domestic events.
On the front covers of illustrated magazines like Paris Match, the battle was portrayed as a kind of chivalric crusade. Caste's aristocratic name helped to fuel such fantasies. The press also made comparisons with the heroic French defence at Verdun in World War I. In terms of the conditions of the combat, the comparison was entirely valid, but there was one major difference. As much as by the tenacity of the soldiers, Verdun had been won by logistics, by what was dubbed the Sacred Way, la Voie Sacrée, the narrow gauge railway and the narrow road that supplied and relieved the French troops. As Yvan Cadeau puts it,
General Decastre said later, it is Verdun without the Voie Sacrée. During the Battle of Verdun in 1916, the Voie Sacrée permitted to reinforce in Dien Bien Phu. There was no reinforce or very low because the planes couldn't land anymore and there was only parachute.
If there was a sacred way at Dien Bien Phu, it was on the other side of the hills, among the endless lines of Vietnamese boys, women and men who kept Giap's forces supplied. French propaganda also celebrated the role of Geneviève de Galard, another aristocratic name, who was christened by the press the Angel of Dien Bien Phu. Finding herself stranded in the base once the airfield had been destroyed, de Galard, the only woman present in the besieged garrison, found herself working in atrocious conditions with diminishing medical supplies and no possibility of evacuating the wounded.
One day, there was a casualty who began to scream as there were maggots in his wounds. And Dr. Grauen, the senior of the medical staff, reassured the injured, telling them not to worry about the maggots as they cleansed the wounds. And when they were in the abdominal wounds, it was vile and hard to endure. But such was the strength and ability of Dr. Grauen that he was able to reassure them.
Des plâtres qui nécessitaient seulement des piqûres d'antibiotiques. Mais il n'y avait pas l'électricité, c'était sinistre.
There was no electricity. It was very dark. In the thickness of the walls, niches had been dug and parachutes placed to serve as mattresses. The darkness, the bleakness compounded to their grim appearance, and these were called the catacombs because they showed just how the fate of a wounded soldier underground could be. There was a young soldier who had been struck on the head and nastily struck as the back section, which had been blown out, was the size of the palm of a hand. We feared he would not survive, but we operated and he did survive. When I passed by in the corridor, he would call me. It was awful because he received letters by parachute. He was a young, married man and he asked me to read out his wife's letters. At times he would sob. I missed out entire sections to avoid making him cry.
Et moi, je sautais des passages entiers et pour ne pas le faire pleurer.
If the French public was being sold one image of the battle, the French government was only too aware how desperate things had become. Only outside aid could have saved the situation. At the end of March, the French chief of staff, General Ailé, was sent to Washington to appeal for direct American air attacks on the Viet Minh forces surrounding Dien Bien Phu. This plan was dubbed Operation Vulture. Yvan Cadeau.
In my opinion, it was not very serious, because from the beginning, the US knew that if, from a military point of view, it was possible, from a diplomatical and political point of view, US governments wanted agreement from the Great Britain governments, and they perfectly knew that Great Britain wanted to avoid any implication in Indochina.
The most hawkish on the American side were Vice President Richard Nixon, who had little political power, and Admiral Radford, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Also, quite hawkish, was the US Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, obsessed by the crusade against communism. Less easy to pin down was President Eisenhower, who gave a press conference in early April where, for the first time, he proclaimed the domino theory.
You have broader considerations that might follow what you would call the falling domino principle. You have a row of dominoes set up and you knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last one is certainly that it'll go over very quickly. So you could have a beginning of a disintegration.
Behind this bombastic rhetoric, the Americans were in reality more cautious. The 3rd of April, 1954, has gone down in American history as the day we didn't go to war. On that day, Dulles met congressional leaders who refused to support any military intervention unless Britain were also involved. A letter was sent to the British government by Eisenhower warning of the consequences for the West if Dien Bien Phu fell. Professor Fred Lugeval of Cornell University explains how Eisenhower urged the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill to help save Dien Bien Phu.
And then Eisenhower writes, and I quote, "If I may refer again to history, we failed to halt Hirohito, Mussolini, and Hitler by not acting in unity and in time. That marked the beginning of many years of stark tragedy and desperate peril. May it not be that our nations have learned something from that lesson?"
Despite these dire comparisons with Hitler, in this case, the British Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, who would spout similar nonsense 2 years later when launching the Suez operation, was more cautious.
Well, originally, when this problem arose in 1954, it seemed to us that the conflict was in its origins a colonial war. It may be that the communists were seeking to profit by it. That was one aspect. And the other aspect, which troubled us a good deal, didn't seem to us that any of the actions then canvassed, such as an airstrike at Dien Bien Phu, would likely to be effective. On the contrary, we thought it would get the worst of both worlds, because it wouldn't succeed. And the only thing that could succeed would be, and we felt that strongly at the time, would be a military action of all three arms on the scale of a Korean War. And we didn't think then that the world was prepared to do that, nor did we think that that was a policy we wanted ourselves to carry out.
Britain's refusal to lend its support meant there would be no American intervention. Astonishingly, during these feverish discussions at the start of April, some on the French side even seemed to think that Dulles had floated the idea of offering tactical nuclear weapons. This is at least what Deputy French Foreign Minister Maurice Schumann remembered later.
He didn't really offer. He made a suggestion and asked a question. But he actually uttered the two fatal words, atomic bomb. I must say that the French Foreign Minister, whose deputy I was, Georges Bidault, immediately reacted as if he didn't take this offer seriously. It was never, never, so far as we are concerned, it was never a practical purpose.
Professor Lugoval is skeptical.
Dulles at least talked in very general terms about the possibility. What did the French think about potentially using two or three tactical nuclear weapons against these enemy positions? And we certainly know that several French officials recorded in their diaries at the time and said in subsequent oral histories that, in fact, Dulles did make this offer. It also seems quite clear that Bideau refused. He declined this offer because he knew what I think any observer would know, which is that if this killed a lot of Viet Minh troops, it would also basically destroy the garrison itself.
Whatever the truth about this murky affair, what it most reveals is the sense of despair and desperation amongst the Allies as Dien Bien Phu moved into its final phase. As the Geneva conference approached, Giap launched his final offensive on the 1st of May. There were only about 2,000 to 3,000 French soldiers still in a state to fight. The last conversation between General Castres in Dien Bien Phu and General Cogny in Hanoi took place at 5 p.m. on the 7th of May, 1954. Hello, Castres. Hello, hello, Castres. Castres, hello, are you there? Yes, General. Well, mon vieux, you do have to end now, but not with a capitulation. That is forbidden. We must not raise the white flag. That would spoil all you have so magnificently achieved. Very well, General, but I wanted to save my wounded men. No, I have a paper here which forbids capitulation. Do the best you can, but no white flag. What you have done is too fine for that. Do you understand, mon vieux? Very well, mon général. All right, then. Au revoir, mon vieux. À bientôt. Half an hour later, the firing had ceased. The battle was over. The valley fell silent. Overall, on the French side, there were 1,142 dead, 1,606 lost, 4,500 more or less badly wounded. The scale of Vietnamese casualties is uncertain, but was probably in the region of 22,000. In Washington, Dulles announced the defeat.
A few hours ago, Dien Bien Phu has fallen. Its defense of 57 days and nights will go down in history as one of the most heroic of all time. The defenders, composed of French and native forces, inflicted staggering losses on the enemy, and the French soldiers showed that they have not lost either the will or the skill to fight, even under the most terrible conditions. And it showed that Vietnam can produce soldiers who have the qualities needed to enable them to defend their country.
For the French survivors, who were all made prisoner, including Luciani and de Gallard, the hell continued with a grueling march to the prisoner of war camps. Many died on the way. Nothing had prepared French public opinion for this disaster. The French government fell, a new one came to power under the charismatic leader Pierre Mendès-France, who had long opposed the war. In July 1954, the Geneva Accords ended the French presence in Indochina. Vietnam was temporarily divided into two parts along the 17th parallel. In the north was Ho Chi Minh's independent republic, and to the south was a separate non-communist government. Elections were scheduled to allow the south to decide if it wanted to be united to the north. These elections never took place, but that was no longer the concern of the French. The Americans had replaced them as the backers of the South Vietnamese government. Sir Robert Thompson, British military advisor in Southeast Asia.
The point about Dien Bien Phu was that it didn't win the war militarily. The French could have held on for a very long time and might even have developed still quite a strong position in the south, because Dien Bien Phu was way up in North Vietnam. I don't necessarily think that it was as decisive as we make out in the military sense. Where it was decisive was it broke the French will to continue the war.
For France, the Indochina War was over, but the ripples of Dien Bien Phu continued to be felt. It was this humiliation that decided the French government at the end of 1954 to begin preparing their own nuclear deterrent. It was no coincidence either that a few weeks after the signing of the Geneva Accord, where France's defeat was sealed, a violent nationalist rebellion broke out in French Algeria, the beginning of another traumatic war that was to last 8 years. If the French army held on so desperately in Algeria, it was to redeem the honour lost at Dien Bien Phu. So obsessed did the army become by this idea that in 1958 it backed an uprising against the government to prevent what the generals condemned as a diplomatic Dien Bien Phu. As a result, the French Fourth Republic fell and General de Gaulle returned to power. Today, Dien Bien Phu is a tourist site where proud Vietnamese visitors learn about the glories of their grandparents' struggle for independence.
When they come here, it seems as if the battlefields just happen again in front of their eyes. Not only for the veterans who fought here, but also the ones who fought in other battlefields as well. The most important factor is that when they have to take a really long and winding road to get to Dien Bien Phu, they realize how strong the will and efforts of Vietnamese soldiers were to defeat the French. They admired the soldier even more.
Back in the West, the French prefer not to remember the battle at all. For the Americans, it is overshadowed by their own terrible Vietnam War which followed. Nonetheless, Dien Bien Phu was one of the most decisive battles of the 20th century, one that inspired anti-colonialist movements around the world, sucked the Americans into a decade of its own war in Vietnam, and influenced French society for a generation or more. There was indeed great heroism and great courage on both sides. But that cannot disguise the truth that Dien Bien Phu was a terrible French defeat, politically, militarily, and morally, and its consequences live on in France today.
Avec le temps, on oublie le plus affreux et on se rappelle des bons souvenirs.
Over time, one forgets the worst. Whatever is said, Dien Bien Phu was for me a defeat. But on the 50th anniversary, President Chirac used the following words. Today, the name of Dien Bien Phu has become the very symbol of military honor, maintained to the extreme limit of human might.
Défendu jusqu'à l'extrême limite des forces humaines. Voilà.
The Siege of Dien Bien Phu was presented by me, Professor Julian Jackson, and produced by Keith Wheatley. It was a Terrier production for BBC World Service.